For sure. Sufi, the People of the Path, Volume 2. Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 2.
The first question. I have often thought that if children were raised in a free and loving environment rather than the insane society that we grew up in, they would all mature into free, loving, enlightened beings. But if this were so, many of the primitive societies would be overflowing with enlightened beings. Why is this not so? First thing, before you can get to yourself, you will have to lose yourself. The child is born in innocence, and if the child never loses his innocence, he will never become enlightened. Enlightenment means you have lost it and regained it. Paradise lost and regained. It is part of enlightenment that first you must lose it. It is as if a fish has always lived in the ocean. It is impossible for the fish to know the ocean. It is so obvious for those who are standing outside, but it is not so obvious to the fish. It has been born into it. It is part of it. It is like a wave. To know the ocean, a little separation is needed. A little distance is needed. The fish will remain unaware of the ocean and will die. But take the fish out, net the fish out, throw the fish on the bank, on the hard sand. There will be pain and there will be suffering, but in that suffering she will for the first time know that she has been living in the ocean. And for the first time a great thirst, a great desire will come to go back to the ocean. And she will make a first to go back. And if she succeeds and reaches back into the ocean, there will be great joy. And she has been in this ocean forever, where there was no joy. But now there will be joy. Now she will be thrilled, blessed. Now each moment will be a kind of ecstasy. And it is the old, the same ocean she has been born into. What difference has happened? A new consciousness has arisen. The fish is no more innocent. The fish is enlightened. In primitive societies, you will not find Buddhas. You will not find Christ. Primitive societies live in the ocean. Innocence you will find, childlike innocence you will find, animal-like innocence you will find. But you will not find a Buddha. A Buddha is one who has recognized his innocence. This recognition makes the difference. But to recognize, first you have to lose. I can understand your question is very relevant. If this insane society drives you into neurotic paths, then the logical mind will say, then why? the primitives are not all enlightened. This society drives you into madness. But through that very driving, you start moving away from your innermost core. Suffering arises. And a great desire to come back home arises. That desire is what religion is all about. To come back home. What the society has done, you will have to undo it. Religion is against the society, the antidote to society. That's why when religion becomes part of society, it is no more religion. It becomes Christianity, Hinduism, Jainism, Judaism. Then it is no more religion. Religion is basically against society. Has to be, because the society takes you away from yourself. And religion brings you back to your own being. It destroys, demolishes all that the society has done. But before it can demolish, the society has to do it. So Buddhas exist only in a very cultured society. Enlightened people exist only in a very insane society. It will look paradoxical, but this is how it is. If you look from this standpoint, then you will be rebellious, but you will not be against the society. And there is a difference. You will be very compassionate, even of all this insanity that is created by the society, is part of the game. It makes enlightenment possible. Take another example. A man has lived always in health. He does not know what fever is. He does not know what headache is. He does not know any kind of illness. Can you imagine him feeling his health? It is not possible. In the very nature of things, he will never know what health is. And he is healthy. So to know that one is healthy and the well-being of health, only health is not enough. One can be healthy, perfectly healthy, and one may not be aware. Because the awareness comes from the opposite. The awareness comes from a dialectical process. The thesis must be opposed by an antithesis. Health must fall into illness, then you become aware what you have lost. And if you can regain it, there is great joy. There is a Sufi story. A very rich man was searching for bliss, for truth, or whatever name you want to give to his search. He has enough money, and he was ready to offer any amount of money to anybody who was going to give him a key. He went from one teacher to another, but nobody could supply him happiness, and he was ready to pay any price. That was not a problem at all. He was carrying big loads of diamonds with him in a bag. And he will put the bag before the master and he will say, "No, take this. But tell me the secret of bliss." Then he came to a Sufi teacher. The Sufi was sitting under a tree. The rich man came on his horse with his famous bag. It has become almost famous all over the countries. And he puts the bag before the master and says, "I am in search for happiness and I am ready to pay anything. Here are many diamonds. crores of rupees worth. You can take them, but give me happiness. And the Sufi did something. Sufis are people who do. Rather than answering, they do, they create a situation. He simply jumped upon the bed and ran away. The master. For a second, the rich man could not believe what is happening. Such a famous master. And then he suddenly realized what has happened, that he is gone with his diamonds. So he started shouting and started running after the master. Now, in that village, the master knew every street, nook and corner. And the rich man shouting and running after him, that I have been robbed, that my whole life's treasure has been robbed. This is a thief, catch hold of him, he is no more a master. This is a fraud, this man is a cheat, and shouting, and he was running. But he could not get hold of the master, because the master knew the streets of the town. But the whole town gathers. The whole town is started collecting around the rich man. And they said, you don't be worried. But he said, why I should not be worried? I have been completely destroyed. All that I had was in the bag, and that man has escaped with it. And he was crying, and he was as miserable as one can be. Then the whole crowd and the rich man went in search and found the master sitting back under his tree, the bed in the place as the rich man had put it, and the horse was standing there. And came the rich man and jumped on his bag, holding the bag close to his heart. A great sigh of relief. And he said, thank God. And the Sufi master says, are you happy or not? This is the key to happiness. Are you happy or not? Tell me. And the man says, really, I have never been so happy. In a primitive society, people are innocent. They are like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They have not yet tasted the fruit of the tree of knowledge. A civilized person is Adam expelled. He has tasted the fruit of the tree of knowledge. He is no more innocent. He is corrupted. But Adam cannot become Christ. That is not possible. First, you have to fall to rise. You have to lose to get. Adam prepares the way for Christ by being expelled from innocence. A new possibility arises, he can re-enter Eden. He can re-enter into the innocence. This second innocence, what Hindus call second birth, Dvija. This second birth, this second innocence is qualitatively different from the first. The first was ignorant innocence. It was not aware of itself. It was not luminous. It was dark. The second kind of innocence is luminous. A light burns into it. It is aware of itself. It is not only innocent, it is innocence plus awareness. So in a way, even this insane society does something beautiful to you. It takes away your bag of diamonds. it creates the possibility of being happy. If you are stuck in it, then something has gone wrong. Otherwise, there is nothing wrong. Going away is part of coming back. Go as farther away as possible, and coming back will be as beautiful as possible. Go as distant from God as you can. The farther you go, the coming back will be more ecstatic. So in a primitive society, enlightened people don't exist. They exist only in an insane society. First thing. Second thing, even a primitive society is not really absolutely primitive. In fact, no society can be absolutely primitive. Society as such means civilization has entered. Even if it is primitive, it may be a primitive civilization. Maybe it has not cars and roads and aeroplanes. That does not matter. That does not make a society a society. A society is made out of rules, regulations, taboos, inhibitions. Even in a primitive society, they are there. Crude. Grass. As primitive as the society is primitive. But they are there. No society can exist without rules. Society means rules. No society can exist without taboos. Society means taboos. No society can exist without repressions. Society means repression. Society means the individual has to fit with the mass. In that very fitting, the individual loses his innocence. He becomes corrupted. So the second thing to remember, even a primitive society is a society. So there is some possibility of being enlightened. But more the society becomes complex, more is the possibility to become enlightened. More the possibility to become insane, more is the possibility to become enlightened. Now it will depend on you how you use the situation. A civilized society creates a great possibility. You can get obsessed. You can get stuck. You can become frozen. That is your choice. Otherwise, the more complex the society is, you are closer to become enlightened. You can use that opportunity. Buddha was born in a very complex Hindu society. That was the peak of Indian civilization, the golden age. The society was very complex, very sophisticated. Buddha was born in it. And all the Tirthankaras of Jainas, 24, Buddha, and all the avatars of Hindus, Krishna, Ram, and others, they all come from the very sophisticated layer of the society. They are all aristocrats. They don't come from the low strata. They are all kings or sons of kings. Why? Because at that peak, the insanity drives you really the whole distance away from God. And then the turning becomes possible. I'm not saying that the turning is going to happen inevitably. I'm not saying that. It will depend on you. If you become aware of the insanity that you are living, you will start turning. If you don't become aware of the insanity and you remain asleep in it, you may continue remaining insane. This is not an accident. that the East is no more much interested in religion. East is so poor now, and society has fallen so low, it is no more sophisticated, it is no more aristocratic. Its problems are very physical, down to earth. It cannot think of spiritual problems. It is no accident that the West is becoming more and more interested in religion, particularly the American is becoming very much deeply involved with religion, because now America is at the peak of civilization, of sophistication, of luxury, of affluence. Exactly the same had happened 2500 years before in India. Then India was the golden bird, just as America is today. America is modern India. The sun is going to rise in the west. The east is deserted. The east is a potential field for communism, not for religion. Eastern countries, by and by, are turning communist. Communism can only be the religion of the east, the lowest kind of religion. Now the American mind, and particularly the cultured American mind, is interested in Buddha, not in Marx, is interested in Krishna, not in Marx. But the Chinese mind is interested in Marx, Lenin, Mao. The Indian mind, they are interested in Gandhi, in Marx, in socialism, in communism. When you are hungry, your religion can be only communism. When your bodily needs are fulfilled, your mental needs are fulfilled, then there is no way other than to be religious. Then you will start seeking for meditation, satori, samadhi. The second question, before coming to Pune, I thought I knew something about helping. Now I feel I know nothing about helping. The most I can do is be present with a client and follow my instincts at that moment. It is a very scary place. In fact, now you are beginning to be a helper, a therapist. When you start losing that ego of being a therapist, healing starts flowing through. That ego is an obstruction. A real therapist does not know that he is a therapist. He is just a medium for God to flow through. And I can understand why you are feeling scary. Because all your expertise and all your past has existed around a subtle ego, around I. Now that no more seems to be relevant. When past seems no more to be relevant, one feels scary. One is losing knowledgeability. And that was your support. And that was your ground on which you were standing. You used to know this and that. You used to know how to help, what to do, what is needed. Now all that is disappearing. Now you will not know what to do, and you will not know the right answers to every question. But for the first time now, if you remain available to the patients, your clients, the right answer will come through you. It will vibrate through you. It will not be your answer that is true. It will be no more your answer. It will be God's response through you. That's my whole work here. I am preparing a new kind of therapist, totally new kind of therapist, whose function is not to do something to the patient, but just to be available. Their presence will be a healing presence. Miracles will happen through them, but you will not be able to say that I have done them. God will be doing them. Are the unknown acts, are the wholes. For the first time you will be really a help, a great help. But for a few days, few months, few years, it depends. If you relax into this, surrender into this, this hesitation will disappear soon. If you don't surrender, if you go on resisting, then it will take many months or many years, or maybe you may succeed in resisting and it may disappear again. Then you will miss a great opportunity. A door was opening, but you didn't allow it to open. My observation is that when a musician becomes a real musician, he throws all musical instruments. He need not have them. Now the music arises in his innermost core. It is not produced by any instruments. When an archer becomes a real archer, he throws his bow and arrows. There is no need for it. When a healer becomes really a healer, he forgets that he is a healer. A man of knowing completely becomes innocent, unburdened by knowledge. And the process is, I am not saying that you need not have any training. No, not at all. I am not saying that you need not know anything about psychoanalysis, psychiatry, medicine. I am not saying that. I am saying you have to know all that and one day you have to forget it too. I am not saying that suddenly a man who does not know anything about archery can become an archer just by surrendering. No. First one needs to know. That is the first part. One has to learn. Then second part and the higher part is that when you have learned all, forget learning. In Zen they say, first if a person wants to become a great painter, 12 years he should learn painting. Day in, day out. He should go on learning all that is possible about colors, painting, canvases, techniques. And after 12 years he should throw his canvas, his brush, his colors. And for 12 years he should forget all about painting. He should never touch about it, never talk about it, and then one day he should start painting again. Now the painting will have something original in it. All that is needed as technique is there, but it is no more in the conscious mind. It is no more part of the ego. It has gone deep into the unconscious. Those 12 years of training, learning, they have become part of his blood and bone. Then for 12 years he simply forgot about it. So from the conscious mind all has disappeared. If you ask him anything, he will not be able to say anything. He will not be able to talk about it anymore. Now he will paint like an innocent child who does not know anything, and yet in his painting there will be all expertise of the technician. Now two great things will be meeting in him: the innocence of the child and the knowledgeability of an expert. When these two things meet, there is great creativity. Ordinarily, what happens? Either one becomes just an expert, a technician. Then you can paint, and you can paint perfectly. But something will be missing, the soul will be missing. The painting will be perfect, nobody will be able to find any fault, that is true. But that is not enough for a painting, that nobody can find any fault. That is not enough. That is needed, but that is not enough. That is necessary, but not enough. Something more is needed. Just to say about a painting that there is no fault in it is not a praise. If a poet brings a poem and you say, yes, it is perfectly as it should be. No mistake, no linguistic mistake, no grammatical mistake, no mistake in the rhythm. Everything is perfectly okay. But this is not praising it. It may be dead. It has to be dead. Life is not there. It is a corpse. Everything seems to be perfect. But something very essential is missing. I have heard about a madman. He escaped from his mad asylum. He was a professor of philosophy. A very clever man he was. When he escaped from the mad asylum, naturally he started thinking how to avoid detection, because they will be searching for him immediately. All over the country search will be made. He was a dangerous madman. And the police will look after him. So he thought it over. What to do? How not to be caught again? And he found out a very, very perfect solution. He knew why people started thinking about him that he is mad. Because he used to make such absurd statements. So he thought, I should do one thing. I should never make any absurd statement, one thing. Second, I should make only statements which are absolutely certain and nobody can find fault with them. I will say only things which are proved by science, and I will not say a single thing which cannot be proved. Unimpeachable, impeccable will be my statements. So he searched in his memory. He was a great scholar, a very famous professor. He found out few statements that are perfect. Nobody can find a fault. For example, the earth is round. 2 + 2 = 4. Things like that. That was his whole conversation. You talk me anything and he will say, the earth is round. 2 + 2 = 4. Things like that he will say. He will only say things like that. Within 3 days he was caught. He was very much surprised. Why? When he was caught, he told the superintendent, but I am puzzled. Not a single statement I have made which can be proved wrong. Can you prove earth is not round? What was wrong in it? How they could detect that I am mad? There is nothing wrong in it. Obviously. Certainly. The statement is perfectly true, the earth is round. And 2 plus 2 are equal to 4. But it is irrelevant. Somebody is talking about his woman and you say the earth is round. It is irrelevant. It is meaningless. A technician goes on doing right things, but they have no meaning. He can make a beautiful painting, but something is missing, meaning is missing. You cannot find any fault with his colors. You cannot find any fault with his drawing. You cannot find any fault. If you are to find fault, you will be not able. But that is not the point. Where is the meaning? Where is the significance? Something is missing. The total is missing. It is a mechanical phenomenon. The organic unity is missing. That organic unity comes out of innocence, not out of expertise. So there are painters who are only technicians. Because of these technicians, there was a great revolt in the world of painting. People revolted. They stopped going to the art colleges. They stopped learning painting. And they said, we will be free painters. So they started free painting. Now their painting may be original. It may have some significance, but they are incapable to paint it on the canvas. They don't know how to mix colors. They don't know how to draw. The idea may be great in their minds, but they have no expertise to bring it to the canvas. That's what has happened to the modern painting. Looking at a modern painting, it is very puzzling. You don't know what you are looking at. The man seems to be original, but seems to know nothing about painting. I have heard once a rich man came to Picasso. He wanted 2 of his paintings, and only 1 painting was ready. And the man was ready to give any amount of money. So Picasso said, you wait, I will bring 2 paintings. He went in, he cut the painting in 2. Now if you cut Picasso's painting in 2 or even in 4, it does not make any difference. Because it is just a mad jumble of colors. And he sold that 1 painting as 2. Another story about Picasso. His paintings were being exhibited. And the critics were surrounding 1 painting especially. His paintings were strange, but that was the strangest that he has ever done. And they were really full of praise like anything. And then came Picasso and he said, who has put it upside down? The painting was upside down. Or another story. A rich woman asked Picasso to do her portrait. He did it. He took many months. And millions of dollars he was going to get out of it. And the woman came. And he said, everything is okay, but I don't like the nose. So Picasso says, okay. Come after 7 days. And then he was sitting before his painting, very much worried. And the woman who used to live with him in those days asked, why you are so much worried? I have never seen you so worried. He said, the problem is where I have painted the nose. I cannot find it. Somebody can be very technically expert. Then the thing goes dead. And somebody can be very innocently, childishly original, but then again, it can't be a real painting. Then people are right. A painting needs both innocence of a child and expertise. Both together. Then a great synthesis arises. One has to learn and then to forget. That's my whole approach here. My approach about therapy is the same. This is my approach about everything. That first you have to know, and then you have to forget all that you know. Then the knowing goes into your blood. It becomes an unconscious milieu around you. It goes on functioning from the unconscious. And in the conscious you remain very, very innocent, original. Then there is great joy. You asked me before coming to Pune, I thought I knew something about helping. Now I feel I know nothing about helping. Good. That's how it should be. Now the real helping will start. The most I can do is to be present with a client and follow my instincts at that moment. That word instinct will change soon. And you will start feeling, instead of instincts, intuitions. I can understand why you have put the word instincts. Because you don't know yet the phenomenon about intuition. Let me explain it to you. When the body functions spontaneously, that is called instinct. When the soul functions spontaneously, that is called intuition. They are alike, and yet far away from each other. Instinct is of the body, the grass, and intuition is of the soul, the subtle. And between the two is the mind, the expert, which never functions spontaneously. So there is no corresponding word for the psychological realm. For the physical, instinct. For the spiritual, intuition. But between the two is the mind. Mind means knowledge. Knowledge can never be spontaneous. So there is no corresponding word for the psychological realm, like intuition or instinct. I can understand why you have used the particular word instinct. In the beginning it will feel like that, because you are not aware of your soul yet. But good, let it be instinct. Instinct is far better than intellect. Instinct is deeper than intellect, and intuition is higher than intellect. Both are beyond the intellect, and both are good. First one becomes alert of instinct, then by and by you will become alert of intuition, and then there will be a kind of meeting of these two. Then both words disappear, then there is totality. Tathata. Then one functions as a total organic unit. That is the moment when you become an instrument of God. The third question. One of the keywords to my and others' experiences here is energy. I can feel it sometimes more, sometimes less. And I also feel that opening myself more to experience it is letting it do the job of change. Still, it puzzles me, as it is a totally new concept to me, and I should like to know more about it. Is it an inner or an outer phenomenon or both? Can one misuse it? Please explain. The question is from Sucheta. She has stumbled upon one thing which is very significant, energy. That's what we are producing here. To those who come as spectators, it remains unavailable. To those who come just to see what is happening, will not be able to see it. And this is the real happening. But this is invisible. You have to become a participant. Only then you know about it. There are two ways of knowing a thing. One is that of the spectator. You go to the movie. You sit in your chair and you see whatsoever goes on moving on the screen. You are an spectator. And this is one of the problems for the modern mind. The modern mind has become a spectator. Somebody is dancing, you are seeing. People are glued to their chairs before their TV sets for 5, 6, 7 hours. Average is 5 hours in America. As if the TV set is their god and they are worshipping. Just glued. They cannot get up. Almost paralyzed. Just seeing. Just looking at. Somebody is making love, people are seeing. Somebody is wrestling, people are seeing. Somebody is dancing, people are seeing. Somebody is singing, people are listening. People have become spectators. And when you become a spectator, much is lost. Your life becomes very superficial. Because God is available not through being a spectator. God is available only by participation. If you want to know what dance is, dance. Don't be a spectator. Don't go on looking. You don't know what dance is if you only see a dancer. You just know the movements of the dancer. You don't know how it feels from within the dancer. How it feels to the dancer. What joy. What ecstasy. What is happening into the innermost core of the dancer. Great things are happening. If there is a real dancer, great things are happening. When Nijinsky used to dance, sometimes he will have such leaps which are physically impossible. Scientists could not figure it out. That big leap is not possible because of gravitation. And another phenomenon was that when he will jump, coming back to the earth, he will fall as if he is a weightless feather. So slowly, it has never happened before. It can't happen. It should not happen. But it was happening. And they were puzzled. And it was not always that it was happening. If Nijinsky wanted it to happen, it was not happening. The moment he will, he will miss. If somebody had come just to photograph him in that leap, he will not be able to do it. He will feel very humiliated. It was nothing for him to do. It only used to happen when he used to disappear in his dance. Then by and by he became aware of it. That when I am not, when the dancer disappears in the dance, then it happens. Then suddenly, gravitation no more functions as if. As if another kind of life starts working, levitation. As if he starts being pulled upwards. Now, You cannot know it from the outside. You can see Nijinsky jumping. You can watch, but you don't know what is happening inside him. Inside him is happening something like Sakori. The West is not aware of this phenomenon. That's why nobody told him that this is Sakori. Had he been into the East, in a Sufi country or a Zen country or a Taoist country, it would have been immediately recognized. And great possibilities would have opened. Just the reverse happened in the West. Nijinsky went mad because he became so disoriented. He could not figure it out what it is. He becomes so afraid of it, as if he is being possessed by some evil spirit or something. That which could have become the door to God became a door to a madhouse. He needed a master in that moment. He needed one who has realized this inner phenomenon. The master would have been of great help. But he was not aware that he needs a master. He was not aware that anything religious is happening. But he became disturbed. He became afraid of himself. How can you see what is happening to Nijinsky? I am here. I am talking to you. You can listen my words. But you cannot see from where they are coming. You cannot see my heart. So one way is the way of the spectator. Another way is the way of the participant. Here two kinds of people come. Spectators come. They miss the whole thing. The whole thing looks like a crazy trip. What people are doing? What is happening to these people? Why so much dancing? Why so much singing? Why so much crying and weeping? What is happening to these people? What kind of meditation is this? Spectators come and they are puzzled. They cannot figure it out. Only by being a participant you will know what is happening. And if you are a participant, then energy will be the word that will become the most important. That is what is happening around. Sucheta is right. She has stumbled on the right thing. One of the key words to me and to others' experiences here is energy. I can feel it. Sometimes more, sometimes less. And I also feel that opening myself more to experience it is letting it do the job of change. Perfectly true. You will feel it sometimes more and sometimes less. Not because it is sometimes more and sometimes less, but because you are sometimes more sensitive and sometimes less sensitive. The energy is continuously flowing. The river is continuously flowing. It depends on your sensitivity. How much you will be able to feel it in a certain moment. It is not that sometimes the energy is there and sometimes it disappears. It is 24 hours here. It is going to be here till I am here, or even for those who will be sensitive enough, after I am gone, it will be available to them. It depends on you. So when it is less flowing, watch. You must have become a spectator. Then it is less flowing. When it is more flowing, watch. You must be a participant. Then it is more flowing. So keep it as a key. Whenever it is less, just become aware that you must become more participant. You must have fallen into the trap of being a spectator. That's why I insist that while you are meditating, keep your eyes closed. Have a blindfold. So that you don't become a spectator. Otherwise, the tendency is there. It is so ingrained. Your whole culture has prepared you to become a spectator. So even if meditation is happening to you and you are moving into energy, suddenly the idea arises, see what is happening to others, and you miss. If you open your eyes, a great change has happened. You have fallen from being a participant and become a spectator. And this is not a small distance. It is as far away as earth and sky. And then suddenly it is no more flowing. You are no more here. If you want to be here, the only way to be here is to be a participant. And if you are a participant, you need not do the job of change. The energy will do it. Let me do it. Allow me. It will happen. All that is needed from your side is not to resist. All that is needed from your side is openness, cooperation, a loving cooperation, not a fearful defense. And yes, you need not bother about change. The change happens very easily. Still, it puzzles me. It will puzzle in the beginning. The puzzling phenomenon comes because you are no more in control. You are no more the master of it. You cannot manage it. You cannot will it. It is beyond you. It is bigger than you. That's why it puzzles. We are always puzzled by the bigger. Because we always want something which we can define, which we can hold in our hands, which we can possess. Anything bigger than you, and you are puzzled. Because the mind feels so tiny, falls short, and cannot figure it out. And once the mind feels that I cannot figure it out, it starts freaking. It starts getting so much frightened that it can start thinking of escaping. Many people escape from here. Once the energy takes possession of them and things start happening, and they always wanted them to happen. This is how human mind functions. They had come here in the first place for something to happen. If it doesn't happen, they are angry. If it starts happening, they are frightened. And fear and anger are the same energy. Fear is positive. Fear is negative anger. And anger is positive fear. The difference is only of positivity and negativity. And this is how people are working. If it doesn't happen, they are angry, as if I am not doing it to them. They are not cooperating. That is the only thing. But they are angry at me, as if I am doing it to others and not to them. They go on writing letters to me that something has happened to somebody. Why it is not happening to me? As if I am responsible. It is not happening to you because you are not cooperating. And it cannot happen to you if you are expecting. Your very expectation is the barrier. And it cannot happen to you if you are competitive. You are thinking that it is happening to my girlfriend or my boyfriend or somebody, and it is not happening to me. If you are competitive, it is not going to happen to you. All competition is out of the ego. Then you are angry. And if it happens, then you become frightened. Then you become so afraid, you start thinking where to go now and how to escape from this place. Because something is happening which is crazy. It is crazy. Crazy in the sense that you don't have any idea what it is. You don't have any mind to explain it. You don't have any philosophy to make it clear to you. Still it puzzles me, Sucheta asks, as it is a totally new concept to me. Right. It is a totally new phenomenon. Don't call it a concept. It is not a concept. It is a reality. It is not an idea. This energy is not an idea. It is the most pregnant force in the world. It is through this force that people are transformed. It is alchemical. It is this force alchemists have been talking down the ages. It is this chemistry that transforms the grass into the fetus, that transforms the iron into gold, that changes the lower into higher, that transforms the sex into prayer energy, that makes you capable of moving into different planes, higher plenitudes. It is not a concept, but I can understand what she means. She is saying that she has no philosophy to figure it out. But there is no philosophy. And I cannot supply it. Nobody has ever been able to supply any philosophy to figure it out. It is so big. Philosophies are so small. Philosophies are in the mind of man. And it is universal energy. Mind cannot contain it. And you should not try that. Otherwise the mind will come in and will disturb your receptivity for it. And I should like to know more about it. Forget. Knowing more about it is not going to help. Being more into it is going to help. And being more into it is the only way to know more about it. Don't do the reverse. Ordinarily, our mind says, first know more about it, then go into it. That seems to be more clever. But it doesn't work. The mind says, first know, then go into it. Without knowing, jumping into it is dangerous, can be dangerous. You may be lost, or you may not come back again, or who knows whether this is good or bad. Divine or devil, who knows? So first know everything about it. But there is no way to know anything about it without going into it. That is the danger. That is the risk, the gamble. That's why I call sannyasins the gamblers. They are ready to go with me without any hitch and hesitation into the unknown. I cannot make them any guarantee. I cannot give them any guarantee. It is not possible in the very nature of things. A guaranteed truth is a lie. The truth cannot be guaranteed. One has to go into it with a throbbing heart. One has to take the risk. The danger is there. Either you will become enlightened or you will go mad. That danger is there. That's why a master is needed and a great love for the master is needed. So you can trust him. So that when things start going out of your hand, he can take them in his hand. If you don't trust him, then madness is going to happen. So I never suggest anybody to go into this unknown without a master. And I know that sometimes it happens that a person can go without a master. But that should be an exception and should not be made a rule. We can forget about it. Yes, it happens that once in a while a man escapes dangers and reaches to truth without being guided. But that should be thought as accidental, and one should not make an ideal of it. It is far better, far happier, far more joyous and celebrating to go with somebody who knows the way, who has been on the way again and again. Sufis say, if you want to ask the way to a certain peak, ask the man who comes every day down and goes up. Ask the postman who goes to the mountain peak to deliver postage. Comes every day, goes every day. Ask the man who knows the path so perfectly that he can go with a blindfold. He can go in darkness without any light. Ask that man. But I cannot give you any knowledge about it. There exists none. Experience is the only way to know it. I can give you invitation. I can tell to Sucheta, come along with me. Drop your resistances, conscious, unconscious. Drop your fears. And drop this mind too, which wants everything to be explained. There are things which cannot be explained because there are things which are mysterious. And those are the real things. That which can be explained is meaningless. It is trivial. It is mundane. All that is beautiful, all that is true, all that is great is beyond explanation. It is a mystery. You have to go into it. You have to savor it. And I should like to know more about it. Good that you want to know more about it. But the way to know is to be more into it. Is it an inner or an outer phenomenon or both? It is neither. Because for energy, there is no in, no out. In and out are our divisions created by the ego. It is like your house. You call this is my house inside. And this is the outside. Do you think the sky is divided between the inner and the outer because you have made a small wall? The sky is not divided. The sky remains undivided, indivisible. There is no in and no out. It is one sky. The sky that is inside your house is the same sky that is outside your house. And there is no way to cut it in parts. And so is energy. It is one vitality. It is one God. It is one life. All is one into it. Neither lower nor higher, neither inner nor outer, neither material nor spiritual. All divisions are egoistic. It knows no divisions. Is it an inner or an outer phenomenon or both? Can one misuse it? No. There is no possibility. You cannot misuse it. Because before you can get it, you have to disappear. You get only with the condition that you are not. So who can misuse it? If you are, you never get it. This is a very built-in protection in it. Nobody can misuse it. Because before you can get it, you have to disappear utterly. That is a basic requirement. Nobody can misuse God. It is prohibited by its inner mechanism. Because before you enter the shrine of God, you have to disappear. And once you are not, who is there to use or misuse? Forget the word misuse, you cannot even use it. It starts using you. You become just instrumental, a passive vehicle, a hollow bamboo. God starts flowing through you. When he starts singing, you become a flute. Otherwise, you are a hollow bamboo. You remain a hollow bamboo. All songs are his. He uses it, you. You cannot use, you cannot misuse, because you are no more. The fourth question, Bhagwan, why do you go on saying, when you find a master, when you are right in front of me? The question is from Anand Vimoksha. I go on repeating it because I may be in front of you, but you are not in front of me. And unless we both confront each other, unless we are face to face, heart to heart, I will have to go on repeating. Vimoksha, I am in front of you, but where are you? You are not in front of me. You are still hiding. You are still hiding in your cave. You are still afraid to come out and confront me. It is a confrontation. It is an encounter. And I have to go on calling you, come forth, come out. That's why I have to repeat it again and again, when you find a master. The master has found you, but you have not yet found the master. I have chosen you, but you have not yet chosen me, Vimoksha. It has to become your choice too, then there will be meeting. And in that meeting will be a disappearance of me and you. The sixth question. You say one should not feel guilty, but how is it possible to avoid it? The slightest negative emotion or quality, if turned inwards, kills oneself. If turned outwards, kills others. It seems to me that unless and until one has fully realized the spirit or become enlightened, there must always be a deep existential humiliation. The question is from Hanna. First, there is no existential humiliation as such. There are only psychological humiliation, and they are created by you. Existence knows nothing of humiliation, because existence knows nothing of the ego. Have you seen a tree ever humiliated? Have you seen a rock ever humiliated? Have you seen anybody except man ever humiliated? Watch nature and you will be surprised. Two dogs are fighting. They don't start fighting like human beings. They are not so foolish. They first show to each other how much I am. They bark, they jump, they show their chest, they show their teeth. They simply show that this is iron. What you are, you show. And the other shows. And then it is decided, because they are not foolish, there is no need to fight. Then it is decided who is stronger. Then the one who is weak one throws his back, takes his tail between his legs, goes away. But there is no humiliation. Remember, if you think the one who is going away, taking his tail between his legs, is humiliated, you are wrong. You are bringing your human mind in it. It is a simple decision. If I ask you, which is bigger, two or three? And you say three. Is two humiliated? Foolish. Just foolish. They are wise people, these dogs. They have decided without any violence, without any conflict, just by a mock fight, they decided. What is the point of going into a real fight when it is decided the one is weak? Of course, the stronger will win. So why go in it? The one who has left the field is not a coward, remember. He had exposed his whole heart, put everything on the table, was not hiding any card, not even a trump card. Seeing that the other has all the great cards and I don't have, it is finished. There is no need to fight and there is no need to feel humiliated. God has made him bigger dog and God has made me a smaller dog, so finished. A man came to a Sufi master and asked him, why I am not like you? And the Sufi master says, you puzzle me. I can ask the same thing, why I am not like you, and become very humiliated. I am not like you either. God never makes two persons alike. You are you, I am I. One man came to a Zen master and asked the same thing. Why you are so pious, so beautiful, so graceful? Why I am not like you? And the master said, come outside. And he took him outside and he shows him two trees standing in his garden. One is very big, whispering to the clouds. Another is very small. And he said, look, one is big, another is small. But I have never seen the smaller one asking the bigger one, why I am not like you? And I have lived it for many years. And there is no problem. The big is big, the small is small. The small is happy in being small, the big is happy in being big. There is no comparison, so there is no humiliation. Hanna is an egoist. I remember many years before she took sannyas, it was not much of a sannyas either. But I never say no. Just out of politeness, I never say no. Why I should say no? She took sannyas in Mount Abu, must be 5-6 years before. When I gave her a name, I remember what name I had given to her. One of the most beautiful that we can give in India. I had given her the name Ganga. That is the most beautiful river, the most sacred to the Hindus. And on the sides of this river, Ganga, has flowered all that has been beautiful in India. Vedas were written there, Upanishads were sung there, Buddha talked there, Mahavira walked there, all the 24 Tirthankaras, Krishna and Ram and Buddha and all the great saints, they all owe something to the Ganges, to Ganga. Hanna immediately refused. She said, I don't like this name. My name, Hanna, is beautiful. Just out of politeness, I said, okay, then I will keep your old name. But that very moment, she became close to me and she has remained close to me. Since then, I have not been able to make any contact. She refused me. I had given her sannyas, but she refused me. Her own ego and her own name and her own past is too much. Remember, it is the ego which feels humiliation. It is not existence. Existence has no humiliation. The bigger ego you have, the more humiliated you will feel. And remember, the reason is in your ego. Existence is completely unaware of any kind of humiliation. The rose is not humiliated before the lotus, because the lotus is so big, and neither the marigold is humiliated before the rose, because the rose has such beautiful fragrance. Nobody is comparing. Nobody has any ego to compare. Nobody is competing. Existence is pure silence as far as comparison is concerned. It is our psychological cancer, the ego. Second thing, you say one should not feel guilty. But how is it possible to avoid it? The slightest negative emotion or quality, if turned inwards, kills oneself, it turned outwards, kills others. There is no need to turn it anywhere, in or out. You can simply watch it, and it disappears, evaporates, neither in nor out. For example, anger has arisen in you. It is a negative poison. Now, there are three possibilities to respond to it. Hannah mentions only two. She knows only two. Many people know only two. One is to throw this fire and poison on the other, this anger. Then it is destructive. And naturally, after you have burned the other, wounded the other, you will feel guilty. I can understand. You will feel foolish. You will feel stupid. You will feel you have done something wrong. You should not have done this. Or the other possibility is, you don't throw the anger on the other, you turn it inwards. Then you hurt yourself. Then you wound yourself. Then you will have stomach ulcers. Then this fire will rage inside you. Then you will be always sitting on the top of a volcano. You will never be at ease. You will be always restless. All joy will disappear from your life. The society, the church, the state is in favor of the second. The society says, don't be angry with the other. Do whatever you want to do with it. You swallow it. If you suffer from ulcer, that is your business. If you suffer from cancer, that is your business. And the society has given you such explanations that the cancer need not be connected at all with your anger. The ulcer need not be connected with your anger. Because if you swallow anger today, just today the ulcers won't appear. They will take years. Maybe after 40 years of swallowing anger, the ulcers will appear. After 60 years of swallowing the anger, cancer will appear. So you will not be able to relate. You will not be able to find any reason that it is anger that has created the cancer. They seem to be so far-fetched. The society has decided that you just behave rightly. The society protects the other because the society is consisted by the others. The society says you can be self-destructive, that is your business. The society is against the murder, but is not against suicide. This is suicide, if you turn your negative emotions inwards. I am against both, because both will create guilt, and both will create complexities. What is my approach? My approach is, anger is there, you watch. you witness that anger is there. Don't do anything about it. There is no need to do. Just look at it. And you will be surprised just by looking at it. It starts disappearing. The cloud sooner or later disperses, is gone. And when the cloud is gone and you have not done anything about it, neither throwing out nor throwing in, you will not feel any guilt ever. And this is how one should relate with all kinds of negative emotions. Be a witness. Just watch it. Sufis call it Sahada. Be a witness. Hindus call it Sakshin. Be a witness. Just watch. Don't do anything. Doing is not needed. All doing is wrong. If you do anything about it, something is going to be wrong. Because you will be doing under its impact. If you do it to other, that will be wrong. If you do it to yourself, that will be wrong. Anything done under the impact of a negative emotion is going to be wrong. And then later on, guilt will arise. But there is a way not to do. But be a watch. Just be a witness. See it. It is there. You are not it. You are the seer. Sit silently when you are angry, when you are jealous, when you are full of hatred. Close your doors. Sit silently. Let the anger be there. Let the anger flash in front of you. Let the hatred move like a movie, and you be a watcher. And you will be surprised. It cannot be there forever. One thing is certain. Sooner or later it goes. It takes minutes only to go. And when it is gone, it leaves no trace behind. No guilt is created. And a man who does not create guilt is religious. I call that man religious who does not create any kind of guilt. The sixth question. Beloved Bhagwan, this morning in the lecture I was fast asleep and suddenly felt a hard weight in my back. At first I thought I must be snoring or making noise, and someone must have begged me to stop, but I found out that no one had hit me. What was it? The question is from Sheila. I had not answered it up to now, because each day when I wanted to answer, she was asleep again. It is not a new question. I have been waiting, but today she is awake. So I thought this is the moment. Sheila, can't you recognize my hand when I wake you? Enough for today.